This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Could climate change bring us the next financial crisis? Yes, indeed, say two new reports. We'll go to London to get the lowdown on the new report from the Grantham Institute of the London School of Economics. Find out why big institutions like Citigroup, HSBC, the World Bank, and the IMF agree fossil fuel companies have developed a huge bubble based on carbon reserves they can never burn. Pay attention. Your pension funds and banks are heavily invested in the next financial crash. Everybody is. From the Canadian tar sands to Australian coal pits, energy companies are loading up with yesterday's fuel until the climate crunch, which is already arriving. John Connor of the Climate Institute says the coal industry is ripe for financial implosion. I'll wrap up with a quick answer to another bothersome question. Why is the super sunshine state of Arizona still burning so much coal? With Nancy LaPlaca. Remember the few people who tried to warn the world about the mortgage bubble? This is that show for you. I'm Alex Smith with Radio EcoShock. In the spring of 2013, stock markets hit new highs. Leading the pack were the most profitable companies in the world, the big oil, gas, and coal companies. At the same time, polls showed the majority of the public believe climate change is real. What happens when these two opposites collide? According to a new report from leading economists, the carbon bubble could pop, leading to another serious financial crisis. To explain, I've reached a lead author of the report, Unburnable Carbon 2013, Wasted Capital and Stranded Assets. Bob Ward is Policy and Communications Director for the Grantham Institute at the London School of Economics. Bob Ward, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi.
Well, I'm glad that we connected because this new report is so hard to believe. How could big money makers like Shell, ExxonMobil, and the rest lead us into the next economic crisis?
Well, the fact is, I don't think they are thinking far enough ahead and thinking about the risks to which their companies and the investors in their companies are being exposed. And actually, it's a relatively straightforward calculation. We know that the overall objective that countries have agreed to in terms of climate change is to reduce global emissions of greenhouse gases to a level that would give us a reasonable chance of avoiding global warming of more than 2 degrees above what it was in pre-industrial times. And because that level of warming is, to a first approximation, related to the cumulative amount of emissions, so not just the emissions in any one year, but the amount of emissions added up over several years, you can come up with a budget beyond which you cannot produce any further carbon dioxide if you want to have a reasonable chance, say a 50-50 chance or an 80% chance of staying below 2 degrees. And so we worked out using a climate model what that budget would be for 2 degrees. And then what we did is we looked at how much carbon dioxide would be produced by burning all of the fossil fuels that we currently know to be in reserves. And that, again, is a relatively straightforward calculation. And what you discover is that we have far more potential carbon dioxide that would be produced if we burned all the world's fossil fuels than could possibly be allowed by that carbon budget for 2 degrees. So you face them with two choices. You either decide we're not going to keep to the 2 degree target, or you're not going to be able to burn all of those fossil fuels. And if it is the latter, for private companies whose assets are mainly all these fossil fuels, that has some pretty profound implications. It suggests, for instance, that their current valuations are not a proper reflection of their true value, because about 60 to 80% of fossil fuel reserves are essentially unburnable. And if you say to any company, well, 60 to 80% of your assets are essentially unrealizable, that means that, you know, there's a real issue here that they are overvalued. if, for instance, collectively, all of the investors suddenly realized the straightforward arithmetic and decided all at once to try and sell their shares, it could, for instance, result in quite a bit of chaos on the World Stock Exchange. So one of the motivations for our report is to help people understand this arithmetic and start thinking through the consequences so we can have an orderly transition that doesn't result in a sort of a mass panic and a potential bursting of the carbon bubble with, you know, all the negative consequences that might have.
Well, let's talk about this carbon bubble. How would it compare to the 2007 bubble of U.S. real estate prices and all the securitization that was based on those mortgages?
Well, it's smaller, and the effect would be smaller because banks are important not just because of the value in themselves, but because they are a source of finance to every other sector. So the banking crisis has had broad implications throughout the economy. Now, with the oil, coal, and gas companies, they are a sizable proportion of the capital on the world stock market. So in London, for instance, about 25% of the market capitalization on the London stock market is accounted for by companies that are involved in oil, coal, gas, and mining for coal. So that 25% then is all potentially at risk, and it would have a very significant impact. But because we're not talking about banks, which are in a key position that affects all other economic sectors, it wouldn't be quite on the same scale, but enough to be something that would cause a great deal of disruption and a great deal of problems. If you think, for instance, about pension funds, for instance, that we pay in, well, they actually invest a lot of money in stocks and shares, and many pension funds hold lots of shares in oil and gas companies because they've been doing very well at the moment with high prices and a large demand. So it wouldn't just be restricted to those companies and the investors in it. It would also have broader implications for most of us.
Yes, we're told the Bank of England was warned in January 2012 that big reserves claimed by fossil fuel companies were a threat to the British economy and the UK investment and banking industry. Why Britain in particular?
Well, actually, all of the major stock markets, New York is also exposed, and in Europe, in Frankfurt. I mean, essentially, the global oil, gas, and coal industry is just that. It's global, and it's present all around the world. And actually, the partners in this report, the Carbon Tracker Initiative, they did an initial report back in July 2011, which spelled out this overall relationship that there were far more fossil fuels than we could possibly burn. And they, despite it being unarguable that that is the case, it really didn't trigger the kind of coming to terms with those facts that one would have expected. There is an element of the world stock markets and investors are in some sort of denial. They either don't believe in climate policy ever succeeding and that we will never reduce emissions in line with the desire of avoiding global warming of more than 2 degrees, or they believe that they can leave this decision to the last possible moment and then escape any consequences. And both of those sort of calculations are very deeply flawed. And to be honest, it also shows that there's been a degree of a lack of learning about the last crisis, because the banking crisis arose because large risks were accumulating in various parts of the financial system, and people were largely ignoring them. Not only were they ignoring them within their own enterprise and company, but they were ignoring the fact that they were growing in all the other companies in the sector. And we have a similar situation here where all these companies are carrying a large risk. And that is a formula for if everybody suddenly then faces a crunch at the same time, that's a formula for a potential crisis that then threatens the stability of the stock markets themselves.
Well, we should give our listeners a taste of the credentials behind this report, Unburnable Carbon. Who did publish it?
So it was a partnership between the Grantham Research Institute on Climate Change and the Environment, where I work, which is a research center at the London School of Economics and Political Science, which is headed by Nicholas Stern, who wrote a famous report on the economics of climate change in 2006. And there's also, and our other partner was the Carbon Tracker Initiative, which is a non-profit organization that monitors the fossil fuel industry and its potential consequences for climate policy. We went through the process of checking our numbers rigorously and had various people review the report before we published. And actually, it's a fairly straightforward process. It doesn't require too much in the way of a complicated calculation to come up with this. And indeed, you know, we've seen other organizations like the International Energy Agency reach broadly the same conclusions as us. So that gives us a sense that what we're saying is true. I think then really the question now is how do we get investors, regulators, and more generally policymakers and finance ministries to start to come to terms with this? Because if they act as if they don't believe the numbers, no matter what is presented, then that really is just storing up problems for them later. They can't wish away the situation. It's fairly clear that there is a fundamental mismatch between our current reserves of fossil fuels and the stated targets for our international climate policy.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from Central London. We are talking with Bob Ward of the Grantham Institute. Well, yes, as you mentioned, there's been some reaction from big players. According to Damien Carrington in the Guardian newspaper, big institutions like HSBC, Citigroup, and the ratings agency Standard & Poor's agree this warning about the carbon bubble is legitimate. What are they saying?
Well, HSBC have been doing their own calculations, I know, and have been looking at individual companies to work out to what extent they are exposed and working out to what extent the value of that company is essentially too high at the moment because it assumes that all of their fossil fuel reserves could be burned and therefore are essentially assets that can be realized. So they've been doing that for investors and for their clients. Standard & Poor's, the ratings agency, also worked with the Carbon Tracker Initiative on another report that was published a few weeks ago, which looked at how the rating agencies should go about adjusting their ratings of companies which hold large levels of fossil fuels. It recognized that there is this fundamental mismatch between the fossil fuel reserves and the climate policy objective, and are beginning the thought process of how ratings might be used to encourage investors to start adjusting their expectations. One of the most perverse consequences of the current situation is that actually many of these oil, gas, and coal companies are only rewarded in terms of a rise in their share price if they each year discover more and more reserves. Now, if you think about it, they already have too much or far more than they can burn. So they're being rewarded for accumulating even more assets, which they can't possibly realize, and that's a rather odd situation to be in. It means that the problem is growing and growing rather than shrinking from year in and year out. And I think the ratings agency is interested in how they might use their ratings in order to try and exert a countering influence to start leading investors to more properly evaluate the value of these companies and the assets that they own.
Yes, for the people like the victims of Hurricane Sandy in the United States, their assets are our liabilities from the perspective of climate. And you talk about reserves, it seems to me it's almost like a possible Ponzi scheme. We've had a situation here in North America where oil multinationals are bidding on deep water drilling sites in the Gulf of Mexico when they haven't developed the leases they already have. It looks like they're just bidding up their claims for reserves to look good for investors. Is that what's going on, do you think?
Well, the investors in those cases, I mean, you're quite right, they're being rewarded for finding more and more of these fossil fuels. But it's based on the assumption that demand will carry on growing. Well, if demand carries on growing, it can't possibly be met through fossil fuels. Otherwise, we're going to end up with this, with a huge problem. I mean, any serious analysis of the science of climate change shows you that if we do warm beyond 2 degrees, we'll be exposing ourselves to a very, very different kind of world from the one that we've experienced. I mean, if we go to 3 degrees or more above pre-industrial levels, that'll be to temperatures that we haven't seen for any extended time on Earth for 3 million years, at a time then when the polar ice caps were much smaller than they are today and sea levels were about 20 meters higher than today. So if we're heading towards that kind of world, I mean, that would be an extremely risky world in which to be. And any assumption that we would just carry on as today, it seems to me to be just not really a very rigorous approach. So I think that, you know, the 2 degree target represents a very real threshold that governments have recognized as something that if we go beyond, we expose the entire planet and societies around the world to huge risks. So investors have to start recognizing that. This is not just some arbitrary political decision. This is a very real exercise in risk management, and they need to understand that if they can't possibly burn those fossil fuels without creating huge, massive risks that they themselves will not be insulated from. You know, nobody can guarantee in a 3 degree world that they'll just be able to carry on with business as usual. It will be a fundamental game changer, transform the planet, and investors have got to start understanding that. Absolutely clear and profound conclusion.
So what steps can we take as a society to reduce this risk posed by the carbon bubble?
Well, I think that in the wake of the financial crisis, we learned that, or we should have learned, the consequences of allowing risks to mount and grow, because eventually they get to a point where they create huge problems. And I think that there was supposed to be a recognition of the fact that one of the reasons for that was that the regulation hadn't been strong enough. But we appear not to be learning those lessons and applying them to this situation. So I think it's about people reminding policymakers of the need to manage risks in the financial markets and the risks that are now posed by fossil fuels if we don't find a way of curbing their use very strongly. Now, I should say that there is one slight additional opportunity for the oil, coal, and gas industry. There is a technology called carbon capture and storage, which allows you to capture carbon dioxide when it's produced from a power plant, and then you store it underground and prevent it from getting into the atmosphere. It's a relatively expensive and still immature technology, and actually we don't think that it could be deployed on the kind of scale that would allow you to burn all the world's fossil fuels. But what it could do is allow us to burn a little bit more than we would do if we didn't have this technology. But there is still no sign that the oil, coal, and gas industry is really investing very strongly in this technology, even though it could potentially help them realize more of their assets. And I think that's a measure of the short-sightedness. And investors themselves have to be more, I think, proactive in demanding transparency about the risk and about the level of reserves and what it means, and asking hard questions of the companies in which they're being, in which they're investing. And if I was an investor who held stocks in a oil, coal, and gas industry, oil, coal, and gas company at the moment, I would be asking that company what plans it has to develop CCS. And if it hasn't, I would think, well, it's not doing it some seriously, and I would think I might, there might be safer areas in which I can invest my money. And that's the kind of thing. So greater transparency, greater awareness of the risk is the first step. And I don't think anybody could seriously argue against that.
Well, unfortunately, as we'll hear from a coming guest, Clive Hamilton, he's the Australian author of a new book called Earth Masters, some of the oil and gas companies have been investing instead in geoengineering research where they would blast sulfur up into the upper stratosphere in order to create a solar shield and thereby allow us to keep burning fossil fuels by cooling the planet artificially. So I'm hoping we don't go that route as opposed to just going for alternative energy like solar and wind and reducing our fossil fuel burning.
Geoengineering has some useful possibilities, but the idea of putting a lot of particulate matter into the atmosphere, as you've just described, falls down to me on the sense that it would start blocking out sunlight, and that would have severe consequences for plants, quite apart from the fact that it would be a very expensive option. And without, you know, you'd have the problem of what to deal with all this material when it came out. But there are aspects of geoengineering that I think are still worth us investigating, simply because the scale of the challenge we face now and the urgency of it means we cannot afford to not to explore all potential avenues, because we may need to use all of them. And the kind of geoengineering I think that is worth looking at very seriously is that in which you find ways of essentially scrubbing the atmosphere, of extracting carbon dioxide out of it and then removing it and reducing the levels and storing it underground. But that kind of solution is far off, may never work, but it's worth investigating. But it is not an alternative to, as you described, finding alternatives to fossil fuels so that we start to cut down very quickly the amount of carbon dioxide we're putting into the atmosphere in the future. Geoengineering seems to me like looking for a safety net, but that doesn't mean that we should stop trying to take steps to limit the risk at this stage, because that safety net may not be practicable in the end.
Well, it's early days, but have you had any feedback based on the movement behind this new report that could give us some hope here?
There have been moves to try and raise awareness on higher education campuses, university campuses. There's a big divestment movement going on being driven by Bill McKibben, particularly in the United States. I think it's really a decision for individual investors as to whether they want to disinvest in fossil fuels. But what I do think is true is that every investor should be aware of the extent to which their money is at risk when they invest in a company that is essentially overvalued because of all the fossil fuels they have. And I think that in the end, it will be an orderly transition away from these companies. These companies need to be planning not for growth in the future, but for gradual contraction as they make less and less of a contribution to our satisfying our demand for energy. And that needs to be an orderly transition. We don't want people precipitously going over the edge all at once. So that's really what we want, is investors to start becoming much more demanding and driving better decisions about the future of these fossil fuel companies.
We have been talking with Bob Ward. He's the Policy and Communications Director for the Grantham Institute at the London School of Economics. Together with the organization Carbon Tracker, they have published a report, Unburnable Carbon 2013, Wasted Capital and Stranded Assets. Find that at carbontracker.org/wastedcapital, or use the link to the LSE site in my Radio EcoShock show blog at ecoshock.info. Bob, thank you so much for warning us about this.
My pleasure, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Nobody does the dirty world burning coal like Australia. It's time to go down under. The climate threat to our financial markets and civilization, perhaps, is no longer a subject just for radical greens. There are ripples of concern right at the core of the largest trading systems, echoed by some of the world's biggest financial institutions. Some say the carbon bubble could bring on the next crash. In January 2012, a well-regarded list of power players wrote the British governor of the Bank of England warning the London Exchange was at the top of a fossil fuel bubble that could break. Lord Stern and a team of analysts have released a new policy paper that explains that risk. From Australia, I've reached John Connor. He is the CEO of the Climate Institute in Sydney. John, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Well, before we go into the details, some of them shocking details, I think, from this new report, what is the overall concern being raised?
It's a bit like the subprime, where investments, mortgages and people's investments continued on the basic assumption that house prices would continue to rise forever and ever. What this sort of research is doing is saying a lot of investments are going into fossil fuels on the assumption that we'll just keep building this and we can keep investing it, and that countries like China will keep using coal, keep using gas. And so what people are doing that in, they are either doing that in denial or indifference to the climate risk, or we think as well, increasingly, that they're doing this to try and get this up quicker before the real costs of climate change start to factor into investment decisions and before we see a flip, perhaps, socially, politically, or even technologically, which will leave a lot of investments in fossil fuel assets stranded.
Well, Australia, of course, is a big player in this, being the world's largest exporter of climate-damaging coal, and Australian mining companies have recently announced even more grandiose projects to mine and ship still more. We did talk to Greenpeace campaigner Georgina Woods about that a few months ago, but could you refresh our memories? What are the coal companies planning on doing in Australia?
Well, look, we obviously, yes, we have been one of the biggest or the second biggest coal exporter globally for many years. And what the research that we've just done, which is built off some of that research that you were referring to earlier, which found that basically if the world does get serious around 2 degrees, and then there's only a certain amount of greenhouse gases or carbon pollutants that can go into the atmosphere. And so we have a carbon budget. And if you apply that carbon budget globally to fossil fuel reserves, the research that the Grantham Institute and the Carbon Tracker found was that only 20 to 40% of assets, of fossil fuel assets, can be used. And so there's got a lot of wasted money there. What we've done is apply that to Australia, where Australia currently has 11% of the global market share. If you apply that to a carbon budget for coal, the reserves that we've already got listed for more than 90% certainty are more than double the carbon budget. And yet we've got another 100 gigatons or so of carbon pollution ready to go in broader resources and reserves identified by coal companies. So we reckon that those investments rest on a huge speculative bubble of climate indifference, denial, or dreaming.
And it may not keep on going that way, but it's hard to believe we would actually leave some coal in the ground. Is that what you're saying?
Well, that's the thing. It's very hard for many in the fossil fuel industry to get their head around. But I think we are seeing investors and pension and superannuation funds starting to look at these things, and particularly those sorts of funds that, like pension funds, who are what we call universal owners, in that they actually invest across all the asset classes across the economy. And of course, they're starting to realise, they're starting to see now, factoring onto those portfolios, the impacts of climate change are already starting to creep on to their books and raising questions then about what goes on. The old thing that many of us have spoken about for some while, that the costs of inaction are going to be much, much more than the costs of action, is actually now starting to get discussed quite seriously at very senior financial and investor levels. And many of these guys actually have a stake in the fossil fuel industry themselves. And so getting them much more active is a central part of the work that we at the Climate Institute have been doing through a range of exercises, so like the Asset Owners Disclosure Project. But this is one exercise which is highlighting this for Australian investments in coal, and also trying to get people to get their head around this concept of a carbon budget much more, because it's not just annual emissions, it's not just emissions in 2020 that's critical. It's actually, if we're serious about climate change, we've got to actually think about the stock of the greenhouse gases that are up there in the atmosphere that are driving the problem.
Well, you know, I can think of a couple of parallel examples in North America, even beyond the tar sands, of course, but the gas industry is frantically drilling more and more fracking wells, even though the price is lower than production costs. I assume it's kind of a scam to generate more investment money. And I'm wondering, is the same thing happening with Australian coal? Are they trying to beef up what they claim as reserves in order to get these pension funds and others to invest in them?
No, I think there's enough of the stuff around here in Australia, unfortunately, that they don't have to blow up what they've got and got access to. There's actually more than enough, unfortunately, here. A bit like the Cornell cliche, the Stone Age didn't end because we ran out of stones. But we're still certainly trying to sell these stones that are going to sink our planet's climate pretty vigorously down here in Australia. And there is a bunch of companies who are completely indifferent to the consequences, but we also know that there are some companies that do take this seriously and have been starting to measure this. And we know some senior companies have actually, even after we've released this, have said, well, we got slightly different to the carbon content of what we have on our, that we're counting. And so to me, that highlights that some of the big company coal companies know that this is an issue and are either trying to race the stuff out of the ground or thinking seriously about trying to move on.
So this new report came from the Grantham Institute at the London School of Economics and from carbontracker.org. I'm wondering, what is the official name of the report? Who is really behind it? And were you a part of it?
So there's two reports that have just come out. So the Carbon Tracker with the Grantham Institute there at London School of Economics have done a reassessment of some work a couple of years ago as the Carbon Tracker did in terms of global carbon budget and the fossil fuel reserves that are on the asset books worldwide. And what we've done is done a report with Carbon Tracker on Australia's unburnable carbon, the carbon bubble that we have here when you apply that to reserves here. So there's two reports, Alex, that have come out in pretty quick succession about these things. And so and I think that it actually reveals quite an interest amongst a range of players. So in Citigroup, we've seen HSBC, we know World Bank and IMF and International Energy Agency are looking at these sorts of things. And so this is taken to the very top of the boardrooms, it's taken to the very top of the investment chain. Some better literacy about these things, and we think that they're pretty important targets, particularly around the world, and in Canada and the US and here in Australia, the political processes aren't that flash. So we are keen to engage with those, but keen also to engage in alternative avenues like big capital, who could actually ironically be our big friend in this climate crisis.
This is Radio EcoShock with John Connor. John, I was surprised to hear those voices agreeing with the assessment of what we might call a second Stern report out of the UK for that part of it. Big financial institutions like Citibank, HSBC, they publicly admit we face a hidden risk with overinvestment in what could be a dead-end economy if we're going to go with fossil fuels. Why are they coming on board now, even though they are, as you say, probably heavily invested in these same companies?
They're identifying the risk. They're not all sort of necessary fellow travellers by any stretch of the imagination. The Citigroup analysis here in Australia basically said, well, you know, that they took a kind of a fund manager approach, which says, well, look, an appropriate response to the risk might be to dig, baby, dig, to get the stuff out of the ground quick, smart, and onto the marketplace before other players do, or other countries. It's more that they're identifying the risks. It's up, ultimately, to the trustees of the superannuation, the pension funds, some of the central banks and the like to actually start to drive some of the action here. So just that they're identifying the risk is important. We're having that discussion. But there are some quite scary consequences that on one level it might actually drive people to rush the stuff out of the ground even quicker, knowing that the gate's going to shut on them in some way, whether it's because capital will realise that the climate costs are going to be much more consequences, or technologies which develop quicker, which are going to provide solutions not just to climate but to things like air pollution in China, will come on and leave them stranded with heavy and complexly financed investments in very big infrastructure-rich things like coal mines and coal export facilities.
Wow, a rush to pollute just for the greed of it. I hadn't considered that, but I'm trying to picture the average worker who's paying into a pension fund now. They've got to think about, well, what is my world going to be like 30 years from now when I actually try and collect this pension? Shouldn't they be saying to their managers, look, we don't want to invest in a wrecked climate?
Absolutely. And I think this is, I think, one of the great new areas of engagement, which is very important. And so we've been working through, as I said, the Asset Owners Disclosure Project, that's AODproject.net, to actually be surveying pension funds and demand greater transparency from pension funds and superannuation funds about the emissions content, about their hedging of their investments in terms of low carbon investments. But we've been doing some work with, there's an RUthevitalfew.org, a way in which people can get connected with their pension funds and superannuation funds and have a direct conversation, because it actually turns out that there are direct fiduciary duty there between trustees and the workers who have got their capital invested with them, being invested on their behalf by the trustees, to respond to some engagement there. So I encourage people to have a look at that. And of course, we've got movements now like 350.org, their divestment campaign that they're taking on the uni campuses here. So I think this is a big, and we've only just scratch the surface of the engagement with the superannuation, the, what we call it down here, superannuation funds, the pension funds in the US and Canada and around the world. Just scratching the surface of engagement with that. It's a very important area there about people, workers demanding that their capital be put to good use, because frankly, we all to some level have been accidental investors in a very unsustainable global economy. We get active with how our money is being invested. We can change the ballgame.
John, in the Guardian newspaper, April 28th, journalist Damian Carrington concluded from the report that he'd read that Australia's coal industry is, quote, ripe for financial implosion. Do you agree with that, and how could that be?
Well, that's he's going off our report that Australian coal is well above its share of the carbon budget for coal. Now, we were asked in releasing that report, you know, when will this bubble burst? The answer is, we don't know, but the pressure's going to keep building. Here in Australia, when people talk, when we raise this, some of the industry analysts say, look, for China, it's a choice between development and the climate. The development will win every time. But they ignore the amount of investment in clean energy in China. They're ignoring policy things like coal production caps. And they're ignoring the interest that China has in dealing with air pollution issues, which are driven very much, particularly by coal, in some of their big cities and their coal power stations. And so there's a high risk there. We don't know exactly when that bubble will burst and how that implosion will play out. But Australian coal investments and the Australian economy, because it's such a big part of our exports, are at risk.
I wonder, yes, is the government, which is actually helping this industry of building extra railroads and clearing the way for extra projects and cheerleading it, is that government addicted to the extra jobs and the extra taxes that they hope is going to come out of this coal boom?
Well, this is, Australian economy is heavily addicted to carbon pollution, a bit like Canada's and some others, particularly Australia and Canada, I think. But and there are certainly so many states. You know, the Premier of Queensland, one of our states, said, "Yeah, we're coal country up here," and certainly been a big booster for the industry. And you know, you can see why. And there's actually many workers and the like that are involved at an employment level. It's not a bigger a part of Australian employment. It's only about 4 or 5% of the whole mining industry of our employment. But yet there is still a lot of money that sloshes through the system, and that is very powerful in the political economy, of course, as well.
Of course, the pessimists are going to say we aren't going to change a thing. We may be unable to alter course and we'll just burn all the oil and coal we can find. Why do you and the other report writers predict that we will change away from fossil fuels sooner or later?
Well, I just think the pressure is going to build, and we have a range of factors. I mean, there are reasons to be pessimistic, but there are reasons to be optimistic. And I sort of call myself a professional optimist, but that's our job, is to keep finding those ways forward. And we don't know exactly the dimensions of how this shift might happen. No one knew exactly when the subprime bubble would burst, when people finally woke up to the shonky investments and the like that were then involved, and the risks that were involved. But I think we are seeing the awakening of the costs that's involved right now, and that's being at the top of the investment chain. And we have a remarkable situation where the new heads of the IMF and the World Bank have become quite ardent in their engagement on these issues and are taking this at the very highest economic levels. To quote Donald Rumsfeld, there's some known knowns and some known unknowns and some unknown unknowns about how this might happen. We have some breakthroughs in technology. We have a key agreement between the US and China. We have, as I say, global capital all of a sudden moving quickly across in this way. We have dramatically ratcheted up social engagement, because I think the social license of many of these companies, if not already evaporated, is evaporating, putting pressure on the actual operation of companies and pension funds and superannuation funds. These things could crystallise in ways in which we don't know. And so our strong advice to business and investors is disclose on this, share the risks, hedge against the risks, and you can do that by some stronger investments in low carbon and solutions, or you can go the whole hog like 350.org is saying and divest completely out of fossil fuels. But you can certainly, at the very least, invest more significantly in low carbon solutions. There's some $60 trillion globally in these pension funds and superannuation funds, and Deutsche Bank say we've probably got about 2% of that in low carbon solutions. If we ratchet that up even to about 5% on some rough estimations, then that's going to throw probably half the extra capital that we need for the climate solutions into the fray. So we're not talking about a complete redirection of super funds and the like as being necessary, but some pretty clever hedging strategies can get us a long way to some of the solutions that we so urgently need.
Well, John Connor, I think your call about a possible financial implosion in Australia could be unpopular there, especially since the media is owned by a couple of billionaires almost wedded to the mining industry. Are you getting criticized?
No, look, it's a pretty torrid public space here in Australia at the moment. We haven't been criticized, and as I said, I've actually very interested. One of the big companies actually has come to us and said, well, hang on, it's slightly different figures to us. So it's actually a quiet realization that this is an issue. When these sorts of things come up, there are certainly the big miners and some of those lobbyists who just scoff at this, that China will somehow scoff at the suggestion that China will not go forward. We've had a very fishbowl debate here around the carbon laws and carbon prices and the emissions trading systems that we've put in place, which is up for grabs at the election at the end of this year. So it's a very insular debate here. But some people are slowly looking beyond our horizon to some of these issues. That's important. We hope to continue to encourage that.
Is there anything you would like to add?
I mean, I guess the other thing to say, what our research also discovered is that, in fact, more of Australia's coal is owned by overseas investors than actual domestic listed companies. And so that actually adds an element of risk here, because should investors who are based elsewhere realise these risks, should regulators elsewhere force them to realise that in a more public way, that heightens the risk as well. So it's quite interesting not to just look at what's happening only on the stock exchanges of the particular country, that in this web of global capital that we actually live in, these risks are increased by the way in which global capital can move very quickly around the place, and that hasn't worked for the climate or the planet in many ways in the past, but ironically it could be one of our saviours.
Yes, TransCanada Pipeline is actually owned by 16 Chinese corporations, and a huge patch of our tar sands have also been purchased by the Chinese, and we don't know what they will do. And as you say, in a global market, money can just walk away if it needs to. We've been talking with John Connor. He heads up the Climate Institute in Sydney, Australia. Find out more at www.climateinstitute.org.au, and look for a link to the new report in my own show blog at ecoshock.info. John, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. I saved one last question from talking with Bob Ward from the London School of Economics. It's technical financially. I didn't really get it until I heard John Connor say the same. Big pensions, insurance companies, and banks are investing in the whole stock market, in the index, without being able to separate out the phony balance sheets of fossil fuel companies. That's a core risk which could shake the whole system. Regulators and analysts, even the ratings company Standard & Poor's, are looking for a new metric, a new way to invest in a real future. Here is that last suggestion from Bob Ward.
I think the critical players here might turn out to be the regulators and the financial markets. We heard, for instance, from some pension fund managers who said that their pension funds were largely tied to indexes, essentially benchmarks of a range of shares whose performance was being automatically measured, and that the pension fund automatically invested in those shares that were performing the best and the strongest. And they said that because their oil and gas companies were performing very well. They were tied by the indexes to these investments. They couldn't get out of them. And that, therefore, would require a change in regulation in order to allow them to start having this the option for getting out of the fossil fuels. So I think regulators will probably be required here to start, in the first place, driving greater transparency in the industry, and then secondly, helping the whole sector understand what an orderly transition away from fossil fuels looks like. So that's where I would put my efforts there. In the UK, it will be the Bank of England. In the United States, it's the Securities Commission. And there are other comparable bodies around the world who will, I think, have to get to grips with this in the very near future.
That was Bob Ward from the Grantham Institute speaking with me from the London School of Economics. I hope you got the big picture need for a financial reform that protects investors from the fossil fuel bubble. The balance sheets of big oil, coal, and gas companies are swollen with supposed carbon reserves we will never burn, because the planet will heat up beyond any capability for business as usual long before the oil, frack, gas, and coal run out. More exploration is pointless for these companies. Nature and the human enterprise demand a business plan to phase out the fossil fuel economy. And now from the Bizarre Zone. In the U.S. Southwest, the state of Arizona has more sunshine than anywhere. It should be the American capital of solar power. But instead, big cities like Phoenix are powered by dirty coal. To explain this crazy situation, I've reached Nancy LaPlaca. Nancy was policy advisor to a state power commissioner, and now she's looking at taking a run for the commission herself. Hello, Nancy.
Hello, Alex. Glad to be here.
Well, Nancy, what the heck? Why isn't Arizona the big leader in solar power?
Well, I know it's interesting, and it's kind of confusing. And right now, Arizona is 2% solar and nearly 50% coal. And let me explain why. Arizona exports a lot of its power, 30%, mostly to California. And if you go to a website like the Solar Energy Industries Association website and you look up solar, we actually have a lot of installed capacity of solar, Alex, but half of it is being sold to California. When you look at the total amount of solar that we have, not a whole lot of it is being used in state. One of the reasons why we export so much to California is because they have a much higher requirement for clean electricity. In other words, their renewable portfolio standard is much higher, 33% by 2020. While in Arizona, ours was one of the early standards and also one of the lower standards. It's 15% by 2025. So that's less, and it's over a longer period of time. And the real issue, Alex, is one that people are just starting to grapple with, and that's really the business model for utilities. And the fact that when you own a lot of coal plants, those coal electrons are so cheap, they're 3 cents a kilowatt hour, that the utilities make a lot more money burning coal than they do from solar. There are various ways that we could fix that, but at this point in time, right now in Arizona, we're kind of stuck. One of the issues that's been coming up lately is called net metering. And net metering is this concept where when you put clean energy, solar, let's say on your roof or the roof of a business, the meter runs backward. But the difficulty from the utility point of view is that if you have large numbers of people that start moving to solar, particularly businesses, because it's one thing to have a couple houses or even a few hundred or thousand homes, it's another thing when your big box stores and your grocery stores and your large energy users start to move to solar, and then the utility starts to lose so much revenue that it really threatens their business model. Utilities have very high throughput, Alex. In other words, it's expensive to run those power plants. If their sales go down just a little bit, their profits go down a lot. Their infrastructure costs, their fuel costs, their labor costs, these are very high. And renewable energy presents a totally new paradigm where, especially for solar, you pay a relatively higher upfront capital cost to build that solar. But over the longer period, over 20 years, it's very, very, very cheap to run solar. but our regulatory policies don't really take that into account.
But it's a strange world in the Southwest Desert. You have a lot of Republican voters championing free enterprise, but the power system seems largely owned by the state of Arizona. It almost sounds pretty communist to me. So how does the state figure into these decisions about burning coal or going to solar?
Well, that's an interesting question. You've got regulated states and deregulated states, and Arizona is a regulated state. And basically, in all of your regulated states, and I'm sure in the deregulated states too, your utilities are very powerful political players. And they're used to having a monopoly. So for 100 years in this country, our utilities had monopolies, and they're used to those monopolies. So when you start bringing in clean energy, Alex, it changes the paradigm, especially for solar, because solar is so modular. You can have a tiny amount of solar or you can have a huge amount of solar. And it's modular, so you can keep building it. It's also closer to load, so you can do away with transmission costs. So solar, in a lot of ways, is more threatening to the utility business model because wind tends to be bigger and it tends to be further away, whereas solar has the possibility of being closer to load, owned by individuals, and it's distributed. For example, you probably know that in Germany, half of the clean energy is owned by local business people, farms, small businesses, and local people, whereas that is a totally, totally new situation in the United States where energy is owned by big corporations.
You know, you talk about Germany. They are thinking about trying to get some big solar plants put on the northern Saharan desert and then having that power cross the Mediterranean to get to Europe to power the factories there. They would love to have the sunshine capabilities that Arizona's got. I just can't still quite grasp why Arizona isn't with the program.
Yes, it's kind of mind-blowing, and people are really surprised by that, although if you live here, you look around and you don't see much solar. And again, I think it's sort of out of sight, out of mind. And as I get out and talk to people, they do wonder why we don't have solar. But in a nutshell, you've got all over the country, not just in Arizona, excess capacity. You've got your electricity use is down because the economy is slowing down. You've got excess capacity. In other words, you've got lots of coal plants. You've got plenty of natural gas plants. And you've got lots of people looking to sell those electrons. And so if you don't have an appetite for solar, then you're not going to build it. So, for example, in California, where they have a high standard, 33% by 2020, those utilities are shutting down their contracts with Arizona utilities to buy coal, to buy coal-fired electrons from Arizona, and instead they're signing new contracts to buy solar. So you need that mechanism, those renewable portfolio standards, to push those utilities into buying clean electrons versus dirty electrons.
And is it true that Nevada has said they are going to quit coal?
Nevada is. And in fact, it's kind of set off a firestorm here, Alex, because there's a very big power plant in northern Arizona called Navajo Generating Station. And when Los Angeles Department of Power and Water said, we're not going to buy any more coal-fired electricity from that power plant after, I think it's 2015, all of a sudden, bam, 20% of that coal plant output was up for grabs. Now, NV Energy in Nevada has said, hey, we're not going to re-up that contract either. And that's another 11%. So all of a sudden, literally in the course of 1 year, you've got 30% of one of the biggest and dirtiest coal plants in the country. All of a sudden, you need a buyer for that electricity. Because with coal plants, you can't cycle them. You can't just say, okay, we're going to turn that coal plant down and run it at only 50%. You have to literally run each unit either full bore or not at all.
And it complicates it that Navajo plant contributes millions of dollars to the Navajo tribe. Lots of Native Americans work either in the plant or with the coal mines in northern Arizona. Can we shut that dirty plant down?
You know, the Republicans put out a press release on me yesterday calling me an extremist, because I'm talking about investing in clean energy. And the truth of the matter is, Alex, clean energy provides 3 times more jobs per megawatt hour. And so really, if we replace that plant with clean energy, we would be adding jobs. We would be tripling jobs. There is a way. It's also a very sunny part of the state. Of course, the whole state's sunny. And it's windy, too. So we have a possibility of putting wind up there where that plant is.
And when I talk to people from the Southwest, they're telling me, well, the summer monsoon didn't really come, or it wasn't much. Our rainfall's down to a third of what it was, and it's hot as heck here. Global warming isn't going to be good for the state of Arizona if you keep going with coal.
No, it's global warming. You know, we half the water in Phoenix comes from the Central Arizona Project, which is the Colorado River. Tucson, Arizona, 80% of the water comes from the Colorado River. It gets pumped uphill 336 miles, and it's 2,400 feet uphill. And as Mo Udall used to say, my old boss, water only goes uphill when it's going towards money. And so people in Tucson do get it a little bit more, but we are looking at a water-constrained future. The Southwest has been hit hard by climate change. We're up 2.2 degrees on average, and that's quite a lot. I think this may be the summer when people start to get it. If you look at the polls, Alex, people do get it that it's getting hotter here. And I first moved here in 1979, and it is hotter.
Well, give us the wrap-up. What needs to happen with these Arizona utilities?
You know, what needs to happen, I think, is the win-win situation, Alex. They need to do what's called rate-basing clean energy and energy efficiency. Because when utilities own the generation, they make a 10% rate of return. And then you don't fight them, you join them. You know, the old, if you can't beat them, join them. So we have to convince the commission to rate-base clean energy and do actually what California did, which is they said utilities get to own half and then you put half up to bid. So what that does is you can have a thriving third-party solar industry and you also incentivize the utilities, you reward them, and you give them a rate of return for building clean energy. Because the truth of the matter, what the utilities are finding is fuel is a risk. Fuel is a pass-through cost. A third of Arizona's electricity comes from natural gas. All that natural gas is piped in from out of state. We send $3 billion a year out of state for fuel. We should be spending those dollars in state.
From Arizona, we've been speaking with Nancy LaPlaca, an energy activist and possible political candidate. Are you going to take a run at it?
You know, I'm really thinking about it. I've got an exploratory committee, Alex, and I'm talking to a lot of people, and I'm really, really hopeful. I feel like I have a message that needs to be heard, and I believe absolutely in Arizona's clean energy future.
Well, I will put a link to your Facebook page in my blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you, Nancy, and good luck.
Thank you so much, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Thank you for supporting Radio EcoShock at our website, ecoshock.org. With the help of listener donations, I've created two new YouTube videos based on interviews from this show. Just search Radio EcoShock on YouTube and select the filter by upload date to get the latest. Feel free to pass those along to people who need to know. I'm Alex Smith. Let's do it again next week as we meet the men who want to run the climate of the world. But now this from political songwriter, folk musician, and union activist Smokey Dimney.
Heaven, let me tell you what to do. Just mix yourself some industrial stew. Slop it all over your lovely land and then export it to others. That's the plan, and when you're done, you'll be extinct. I mean gone, like the dinos and the dodos. So how'd we get into this awful mess? I mean, can't we rely on scientists? Tell us how to stay away from trouble and fix those problems on the double. I mean, why not have solar and wind power, electric cars, ecological farms? Well, you know, big business is slow to change, and to slow things more, they try to arrange it. So politicians owe them lots for getting elected and being big shots. At least they act like big shots. You and I know who pulls their chains. So if an oil company owns a president, he ain't likely to call for disarmament, cause there's nothing big oil likes more than war. What else are all those big vehicles for than riding all over the desert, dropping bombs, all looking for one guy? I mean, 200,000 soldiers all out looking for one guy. John Wayne must be rolling in his grave. Now the problem in the rest of the global village is that nobody's looking at the dire image of oceans rising and forests burning. I mean, why think of that when you're all yearning for a trip to Cuba or someplace else warm, like Tuk to Yuk Tuk? Now maybe this makes you all kind of shocked and you ask why doesn't our government act? But I already told you they're told what to do by corporations more powerful than you. So maybe you should start to protest. I mean, yell at those guys. The whole lot of them. And there's lots of practical things you can do, like sell your car and buy walking shoes, shop organic, ride a bike, buy local produce, and learn more too. Find out who makes all the bad decisions and get rid of them right now.